cripple in his arms. Her head hung back, and her long hair swept the ground. As they entered the circle, the bandits could perceive by the firelight the unearthly pallor of the young girl and of Diavolaccio. This apparition was so strange and so solemn that everyone rose, with the exception of Carlini, who remained seated and ate and drank calmly. Diavolaccio advanced amidst the most profound silence and laid Rita at the captain's feet. Then everyone could understand the cause of the unearthly pallor of the young girl and the bandit. A knife was plunged up to the hilt in Rita's left breast. Everyone looked at Carlini. The sheath at his belt was empty. "Ah," said the chief, "I now understand why Carlini stayed behind." All savage natures appreciate a desperate deed. No other of the bandits would perhaps have done the same, but they all understood what Carlini had done. "Now then," cried Carlini, rising in his turn and approaching the corpse, his hand on the butt of one of his pistols, "does anyone dispute the possession of this woman with me?" "No," returned the chief, "she is thine." Carlini raised her in his arms and carried her out of the circle of light caused by the fire. Cucumetto placed his sentinels for the night, and the bandits wrapped themselves in their cloaks and lay down before the fire. At midnight, the sentinel gave the alarm, and in an instant all were on the alert. It was Rita's father, who brought his daughter's ransom in person. "Here," said he to Cucumetto, "here are 300 piastres. Give me back my child." But the chief, without taking the money, made a sign to him to follow him. The old man obeyed. They both advanced beneath the trees through whose branches streamed the moonlight. Cucumetto stopped at last and pointed to two persons grouped at the foot of a tree. "There," said he, "demand thy child of Carlini. He will tell thee what has become of her," and he returned to his companions. The old man remained motionless. He felt that some great and unforeseen misfortune hung over his head. At length he advanced towards the group, which he could not comprehend. As he approached, Carlini raised his head, and the forms of two persons became visible to the old man's eyes. A female lay on the ground, her head resting on the knees of a man who was seated by her. As he raised his head, the female's face became visible. The old man recognized his child, and Carlini recognized the old man. "I expected thee," said the bandit to Rita's father. "Wretch," returned the old man, "what hast thou done?" And he gazed with terror on Rita, pale and bloody, a knife buried in her bosom. A ray of moonlight poured through the trees and lighted up the face of the dead. "Cucumetto had violated thy daughter," said the bandit. "I loved her, therefore I slew her, for she would have served as the sport of the whole band." The old man spoke not, and grew pale as death. "Now," continued Carlini, "if I have done wrongly, avenge her," and withdrawing the knife from the wound in Rita's bosom, he held it out to the old man with one hand, whilst with the other he tore open his vest. "Thou hast done well," returned the old man in a hoarse voice. "Embrace me, my son." Carlini threw himself, sobbing like a child, into the arms of his mistress's father. These were the first tears the man of blood had ever wept. "Now," said the old man, "aid me to bury my child." Carlini fetched two pickaxes, and the father and the lover began to dig at the foot of a huge oak, beneath which the young girl was to repose. When the grave was formed, the father embraced her first, and then the lover. Afterwards, one taking the head, the other the feet, they placed her in the grave. Then they knelt on each side of the grave and said the prayers of the dead. Then, when they had finished, they cast the earth over the corpse until the grave was filled. Then, extending his hand, the old man said, "I thank you, my son, and now leave me alone." "Yet," replied Carlini, "leave me, I command you." Carlini obeyed, rejoined his comrades, folded himself in his cloak, and soon appeared as deep asleep as the rest. It had been resolved the night before to change their encampment. An hour before daybreak, Cucumetto aroused his men and gave the word to march. But Carlini would not quit the forest without knowing what had become of Rita's father. He went towards the place where he had left him. He found the old man suspended from one of the branches of the oak which shaded his daughter's grave. He then took an oath of bitter vengeance over the dead body of the one and the tomb of the other. But he was unable to complete this oath, for 2 days afterwards, in a rencontre with the Roman carbineers, Carlini was killed. There was some surprise, however, that, as he was with his face to the enemy, he should have received a ball between the shoulders. That astonishment ceased when one of the brigands remarked to his comrades that Cucumetto was stationed 10 paces in Carlini's rear when he fell. On the morning of the departure from the forest of Frosinone, he had followed Carlini in the darkness, had heard his oath of vengeance, and, like a wise man, anticipated it. They told 10 other stories of this bandit chief, each more singular than the other. Thus, from Fondi to Boruse, everyone trembles at the name of Cucumetto. These narratives were frequently the themes of conversation between Luigi and Teresa. The young girl trembled very much at all these tales, but Vampa reassured her with a smile, tapping the butt of his good fowling piece, which threw its ball so well, and if that did not restore her courage, he pointed to a crow perched on some dead branch, took an aim, touched the trigger, and the bird fell dead at the foot of the tree. Time passed on, and the 2 young people had settled to be married when Vampa should be 20 and Teresa 19 years of age. They were both orphans and had only their employer's leave to ask, which had been already sought and obtained. One day, when they were talking over their plans for the future, they heard 2 or 3 reports of firearms, and then suddenly a man came out of the wood near which the 2 young persons used to graze their flocks, and hurried towards them. When he came within hearing, he exclaimed, "I am pursued. Can you conceal me?" They knew full well that this fugitive must be a bandit, but there is an innate sympathy between the Roman brigand and the Roman peasant, and the latter is always ready to aid the former. Vampa, without saying a word, hastened to the stone that closed up the entrance to their grotto, drew it away, made a sign to the fugitive to take refuge there in a retreat unknown to everyone, closed the stone upon him, and then went and resumed his seat by Teresa. Instantly afterwards, 4 carbineers on horseback appeared on the edge of the wood. 3 of them appeared to be looking for the fugitive, whilst the 4th dragged a brigand prisoner by the neck. The 3 carbineers, scrutinized on all sides, saw the young peasants and, galloping up, interrogated them. They had seen no one. "That is very annoying," said the brigadier, "for the man we are looking for is the chief." "Cucumetto?" cried Luigi and Teresa at the same moment. "Yes," replied the brigadier. "And, as his head is valued at 1,000 Roman crowns, there would have been 500 for you if you had helped us to catch him." The 2 young persons exchanged looks. The brigadier had a moment's hope. 500 Roman crowns are 3,000 francs, and 3,000 francs are a fortune for 2 poor orphans who are going to be married. "Yes, it is very annoying," said Vampa, "but we have not seen him." Then the carbineers scoured the country in different directions, but in vain. Then, after a time, they disappeared. Vampa then removed the stone, and Cucumetto came out. He had seen through the crevices in the granite the 2 young peasants talking with the carbineers, and guessed the subject of their parley. He had read in the countenances of Luigi and Teresa their steadfast resolution not to surrender him, and he drew from his pocket a purse full of gold, which he offered to them. But Vampa raised his head proudly. As to Teresa, her eyes sparkled when she thought of all the fine gowns and gay jewelry she could buy with this purse of gold. Cucumetto was a cunning fiend, and had assumed the form of a brigand instead of a serpent, and this look of Teresa revealed to him that she was a worthy daughter of Eve. He returned to the forest, pausing several times on his way, under the pretext of saluting his protectors. Several days elapsed, and they neither saw nor heard of Cucumetto. 34. Vampa. The time of the carnival was at hand. The Conte di San Felice announced a grand masked ball to which all that were distinguished in Rome were invited. Teresa had a great desire to see this ball. Luigi asked permission of his protector, the steward, that she and he might be present amongst the servants of the house. This was granted. The ball was given by the Count for the particular pleasure of his daughter Carmela, whom he adored. Carmela was precisely the age and figure of Teresa, and Teresa was as handsome as Carmela. On the evening of the ball, Teresa was attired in her best. Her most brilliant hair ornaments and gayest glass beads, she was in the costume of the women of Frascati. Luigi wore the very picturesque garb of the Roman peasant at holiday time. They both mixed, as they had leave to do, with the servants and peasants. The fête was magnificent. Not only was the villa brilliantly illuminated, but thousands of coloured lanterns were suspended from the trees in the garden, and very soon the palace overflowed to the terraces, and the terraces to the garden walks. At each cross-path was an orchestra, and tables spread with refreshments. The guests stopped, formed quadrilles, and danced in every part of the grounds they pleased. Carmela was attired like a woman of Cennino. Her cap was embroidered with pearls, the pins in her hair were of gold and diamonds, her girdle was of Turkey silk with large embroidered flowers, her bodice and skirt were of cashmere, her apron of Indian muslin, and the buttons of her corset were of jewels. Two of her companions were dressed, the one as a woman of Nettuno, and the other as a woman of Lagricia. Four young men of the richest and noblest families of Rome accompanied them with that Italian freedom which has not its parallel in any other country of the world. They were attired as peasants of Albano, Velletri, Civita Castellana, and Sora. We need hardly add that these peasant costumes, like those of the females, were brilliant with gold and jewels. Carmela wished to make a uniform quadrille, but there was one lady wanting. Carmela looked all around her, but not one of the guests had a costume similar to her own or those of her companions. The Conte San Felice pointed out to her, in the group of peasants, Teresa, who was hanging on Luigi's arm. "Will you allow me, father?" said Carmela. "Certainly," replied the Count. "Are we not in carnival time?" Carmela turned towards the young man who was talking with her, and saying a few words to him, pointed with her finger to Teresa. The young man followed with his eyes the lovely hand which made this indication, bowed in obedience, and then went to Teresa and invited her to dance in a quadrille directed by the Count's daughter. Teresa felt something like a flame pass over her face. She looked at Luigi, who could not refuse his assent. Luigi slowly relinquished Teresa's arm, which he had held beneath his own, and Teresa, accompanied by her elegant cavalier, took her appointed place with much agitation in the aristocratic quadrille. Certainly, in the eyes of an artist, the exact and strict costume of Teresa had a very different character from that of Carmela and her companions, and Teresa was frivolous and coquettish, and thus the embroidery and muslins, the cashmere waist girdles, all dazzled her, and the reflection of sapphires and diamonds almost turned her giddy brain. Luigi felt a sensation hitherto unknown arising in his mind. It was like an acute pain which gnawed at his heart, and then passed thrillingly throughout his frame, chasing through his veins and pervading his entire body. He followed with his eye each movement of Teresa and her cavalier. When their hands touched, he felt as though he should swoon. Every pulse beat with violence, and it seemed as though a bell were ringing in his ears. When they spoke, although Teresa listened timidly and with downcast eyes to the conversation of her cavalier, as Luigi could read in the ardent looks of the good-looking young man that his language was that of praise, it seemed as if the whole world was turning round him, and all the voices of hell were whispering in his ears ideas of murder and assassination. Then, fearing that his paroxysm might get the better of him, he clutched with one hand the branch of a tree against which he was leaning, and with the other convulsively grasped the dagger with a carved handle which was in his belt, and which, unwittingly, he drew from the scabbard from time to time. Luigi was jealous. He felt that, influenced by her ambition and coquettish disposition, Teresa might escape him. The young peasant girl, at first timid and scared, soon recovered herself. We have said that Teresa was handsome, but this is not all. Teresa was replete with all those wild graces which are so much more potent than our affected and studied elegances. She had almost all the honours of the quadrille, and if she were envious of the Conte San Felice's daughter, we will not undertake to say that Carmela was not jealous of her. And with overpowering compliments, her handsome cavalier led her back to the place whence he had taken her and where Luigi awaited her. Twice or thrice during the dance, the young girl had glanced at Luigi, and each time she saw he was pale and his features agitated. Once, even, the blade of his knife, half drawn from its sheath, had dazzled her eyes with its sinister glare. Thus it was almost trembling that she resumed her lover's arms. The quadrille had been most perfect, and it was evident that there was a great demand for a second edition, Carmela alone objecting to it. But the Conte San Felice begged his daughter so earnestly that she acceded to it. One of the cavaliers then hastened to invite Teresa, without whom it was impossible the quadrille could be formed, but the young girl had disappeared. The truth was that Luigi had not felt the strength to support another such trial, and half by persuasion and half by force, he had removed Teresa towards another part of the garden. Teresa had yielded in spite of herself, but when she looked at the agitated countenance of the young man, she understood by his silence and trembling voice that something strange was passing within him. She herself was not exempt from internal emotion, and, without having done anything wrong, yet fully comprehended that Luigi was right in reproaching her. Why, she did not know, but yet she did not the less feel that these reproaches were merited. However, to Teresa's great astonishment, Luigi remained mute, and not a word escaped his lips the rest of the evening. When the chill of the night had driven away the guests from the gardens, and the gates of the villa were closed on them for the fete indoors, he took Teresa quite away, and as he left her at her home, he said, "Teresa, what were you thinking of as you danced opposite the young Contessa de San Felice?" "I thought," replied the young girl, with all the frankness of her nature, "that I would give half my life for a costume such as she wore." "And what said your cavalier to you?" "He said it only depended on myself to have it, and I had only one word to say." "He was right," said Luigi. "Do you desire it as ardently as you say?"
"Yes."
"Well, then, you shall have it." The young girl, much astonished, raised her head to look at him, but his face was so gloomy and terrible that her words froze to her lips. As Luigi spoke thus, he left her. Teresa followed him with her eyes into the darkness as long as she could, and when he had quite disappeared, she entered her apartment with a sigh. That night, a great accident happened, no doubt from the imprudence of some servant who had neglected to extinguish the lights. The Villa de San Felice took fire in the rooms adjoining the very apartment of the lovely Carmela. Awoke in the night by the light of the flames, she had sprung out of bed, wrapped herself in a dressing gown, and attempted to escape by the door, but the corridor by which she hoped to fly was already a prey to the flames. She had then returned to her room, calling for help as loudly as she could, when suddenly her window, which was 20 feet from the ground, was opened. A young peasant jumped into the chamber, seized her in his arms, and with superhuman skill and strength conveyed her to the turf of the grass plot, where she fainted. When she recovered, her father was by her side. All the servants surrounded her, offering her assistance. An entire wing of the villa was burnt down, but what was that, as Carmela was safe and uninjured? Her preserver was everywhere sought for, but her deliverer did not appear. He was inquired for everywhere, but no one had seen him. Carmela was greatly troubled that she had not recognized him. As the Count was immensely rich, excepting the danger Carmela had run, and, as appeared to him, the marvellous manner in which she had escaped, which was rather a favour of Providence than a real misfortune, the loss occasioned by the conflagration was to him but a trifle. The next day, at the usual hour, the two young peasants were on the borders of the forest. Luigi arrived first. He came towards Teresa in high spirits, and seemed to have completely forgotten the events of the previous evening. The young girl was very pensive, but seeing Luigi so cheerful, she, on her part, assumed a smiling air, which was natural to her when no excitement of passion came to disturb her. Luigi took her arm beneath his own, and led her to the door of the grotto. Then he paused. The young girl, perceiving that there was something extraordinary, looked at him steadfastly. "Teresa," said Luigi, "yesterday evening you told me you would give all the world to have a costume similar to that of the Count's daughter." "Yes," replied Teresa with astonishment, "but I was mad to utter such a wish, and I replied, 'Very well, you shall have it.'" "Yes," replied the young girl, whose astonishment increased at every word uttered by Luigi, "but of course your reply was only to please me. I have promised no more than I have given you, Teresa," said Luigi proudly. "Go into the grotto and dress yourself." At these words he drew away the stone and showed Teresa the grotto, lighted up by 2 wax lights which burnt on each side of a splendid mirror. On a rustic table made by Luigi were spread out the pearl necklace and the diamond pins, and on a chair at the side was laid the rest of the costume. Teresa uttered a cry of joy, and without inquiring whence this attire came, or even thanking Luigi, darted into the grotto, transformed into a dressing room. Luigi pushed the stone behind her, for he saw on the crest of a small adjacent hill, which prevented him from seeing Palestrina from where he was, a traveller on horseback, who stopped a moment as if uncertain of his road, and thus presented in the blue sky that perfect outline peculiar to the distances of southern climes. When he saw Luigi, he put his horse into a gallop and advanced towards him. Luigi was not mistaken. The traveller, who was going from Palestrina to Tivoli, had mistaken his way. The young man directed him, but as at a quarter of a mile distance the road again divided into 3 ways, and on reaching these the traveller might again stray from his route, he begged Luigi to be his guide. Luigi threw his cloak on the ground, placed his carbine on his shoulder, and, freed from his heavy covering, preceded the traveller with the rapid step of a mountaineer, which a horse can scarcely keep up with. In 10 minutes, Luigi and the traveller reached the crossroads alluded to by the young shepherd. On arriving there, with an air as majestic as that of an emperor, he stretched his hand towards that one of the roads which the traveller was to follow. "That is your road, Excellency, and now you cannot again mistake." "And here is your recompense," said the traveller, offering the young herdsman some pieces of small money. "Thank you," said Luigi, drawing back his hand. "I render a service. I do not sell it." "Well," replied the traveller, who seemed used to this difference between the civility of a man of the cities and the pride of the mountaineer, "if you refuse pay, you will perhaps accept of a present." "Ah, yes, that is another thing. Then, said the traveller, take these two Venice sequins and give them to your bride to make herself a pair of earrings. And then do you take this poniard, said the young herdsman. You will not find one better carved between Albana and Civita Castellana. I accept it, answered the traveller, but then the obligation will be on my side, for this poniard is worth more than two sequins. For a dealer, perhaps, but for me, who engraved it myself, it is hardly worth a piastre. What is your name? Inquired the traveller. Luigi Vampa, replied the shepherd, with the same air as he would have replied, Alexander, King of Macedon. And yours? I, said the traveller, am called Sinbad the Sailor. Franz d'Epernay started with surprise. Sinbad the Sailor? He said. Yes, replied the narrator. That was the name which the traveller gave to Vampa as his own. Well, and what have you to say against this name? Inquired Albert. It is a very pretty name, and the adventures of the gentleman of that name amused me very much in my youth, I must confess. Franz said no more. The name of Sinbad the Sailor, as may be well supposed, awakened in him a world of recollections, as had the name of the Count of Monte Cristo on the previous evening. Proceed, said he to the host. Vampa put the two sequins haughtily into his pocket and slowly returned by the way he had gone. As he came within 200 or 300 paces of the grotto, he thought he heard a cry. He listened to know whence this sound could proceed. A moment afterwards, and he heard his own name pronounced distinctly. The cry proceeded from the grotto. He bounded like a chamois, cocking his carbine as he went, and in a moment reached the summit of a hill opposite to that on which he had perceived the traveller. Thence cries of help came more distinctly on his ear. He cast his eyes around him and saw a man carrying off Teresa, as did the centaur Nessus de Janeiro. This man, who was hastening towards the wood, was already 3/4 of the way on the road from the grotto to the forest. Vampa measured the distance. The man was at least 200 paces in advance of him, and there was not a chance of overtaking him. The young shepherd stopped, as if his feet had been rooted to the ground. Then he put the butt of his carbine to his shoulder, took aim at the ravisher, followed him for a second on his track, and then fired. The ravisher stopped suddenly, his knees bent under him, and he fell with Teresa in his arms. The young girl rose instantly, but the man lay on the earth, struggling in the agonies of death. Vampa then rushed towards Teresa, for at 10 paces from the dying man, her legs had failed her, and she had dropped on her knees, so that the young man feared the ball that had brought down his enemy had also wounded his betrothed. Fortunately, she was unscathed, and it was fright alone that had overcome Teresa. When Luigi had assured himself that she was safe and unharmed, he turned towards the wounded man. He had just expired, with clenched hands, his mouth in a spasm of agony, and his hair on end in the sweat of death. His eyes remained open and menacing. Vampa approached the carcass and recognized Cucumetto. From the day on which the bandit had been saved by the two young peasants, he had been enamoured of Teresa, and had sworn she should be his. From that time he had watched them, and profiting by the moment when her lover had left her alone whilst he guided the traveller on his way, had carried her off, and believed he at length had her in his power, when the ball, directed by the unerring skill of the young herdsman, had pierced his heart. Vampa gazed on him for a moment without betraying the slightest emotion, whilst, on the contrary, Teresa, shuddering in every limb, dared not approach the slain ruffian but by degrees, and threw a hesitating glance at the dead body over the shoulder of her lover. Suddenly Vampa turned towards his mistress. "Ah, ah," said he, "good, good, you are attired. It is now my turn to dress myself." Teresa was clothed from head to foot in the garb of the Conte San Felice's daughter. Vampa took Cucumetto's body in his arms and conveyed it to the grotto, whilst in her turn Teresa remained outside. If a second traveller had passed, he would have seen a strange thing. a shepherdess watching her flock, clad in a cashmere gown, with earrings and necklace of pearls, diamond pins and buttons of sapphires, emeralds and rubies. He would, no doubt, have believed that he had returned to the times of Florian, and would have declared on reaching Paris that he had met a shepherdess of the Alps seated at the foot of the Sabini Hill. At the end of a quarter of an hour, Vampa quitted the grotto. His costume was no less elegant than that of Teresa. He wore a vest of garnet-coloured velvet with buttons of cut gold, a silk waistcoat covered with embroidery, a Roman scarf tied round his neck, a cartouche box worked with gold and red and green silk, sky-blue velvet breeches fastened above the knee with diamond buckles, garters of deerskin worked with a thousand arabesques, and a hat whereon hung ribbons of all colours. Two watches hung from his girdle, and a splendid poniard was at his belt. Teresa uttered a cry of admiration. Vampa, in this attire, resembled a painting by Leopold Robert or Schnetz. He had assumed the entire costume of Cucumetto. The young man saw the effect produced on his betrothed, and a smile of pride passed over his lips. "Now," he said to Teresa, "are you ready to share my fortune, whatever it may be?" "Oh, yes," exclaimed the young girl enthusiastically. "And follow me wherever I go, to the world's end. Then take my arm and let us on. We have no time to lose." The young girl did so without questioning her lover as to where he was conducting her, for he appeared to her at this moment as handsome, proud, and powerful as a god. They went towards the forest and soon entered it. We need scarcely say that all the paths of the mountain were known to Vampa. He therefore went forward without a moment's hesitation, although there was no beaten track. But he knew his path by looking at the trees and bushes, and thus they kept on advancing for nearly an hour and a half. At the end of this time, they had reached the thickest of the forest. A torrent, whose bed was dry, led into a deep gorge. Vampa took this wild road, which, enclosed between two ridges and shadowed by the tufted umbrage of the pines, seemed, but for the difficulties of its descent, that path to Avernus of which Virgil speaks. Teresa had become alarmed at the wild and deserted look of the plain around her, and pressed closely against her guide, not uttering a syllable. But as she saw him advance with even step and composed countenance, she endeavoured to repress her emotion. Suddenly, about 10 paces from them, a man advanced from behind a tree and aimed at Vampa. "Not another step," he said, "or you are a dead man." "What then?" said Vampa, raising his hand with a gesture of disdain, whilst Teresa, no longer able to restrain her alarm, clung closely to him. "Do wolves rend each other?" "Who are you?" inquired the sentinel. "I am Luigi Vampa, shepherd of the farm of San Felice. What do you want?" "I would speak with your companions, who are in the recess at Rocca Bianca." "Follow me, then," said the sentinel, "or, as you know your way, go first." Vampa smiled disdainfully at this precaution of the bandit, went before Teresa, and continued to advance with the same firm and easy step as before. At the end of 10 minutes, the bandit made them a sign to stop. The two young persons obeyed. Then the bandit thrice imitated the cry of a crow. A croak answered this signal. "Good," said the sentry, "you may now advance." Luigi and Teresa again set forward. As they advanced, Teresa clung tremblingly to her lover as she saw through the trees arms appear and the barrels of carbines shine. The retreat of Rocca Bianca was at the top of a small mountain, which, no doubt in former days, had been a volcano, an extinct volcano before the days when Remus and Romulus had deserted Alba to come and found the city of Rome. Teresa and Luigi reached the summit and all at once found themselves in the presence of 20 bandits. "Here is a young man who seeks and wishes to speak to you," said the sentinel. "What has he to say?" inquired the man who was in command in the chief's absence. "I wish to say that I am tired of a shepherd's life," was Vampa's reply. "Ah, I understand," said the lieutenant, "and you seek admittance into our ranks. "Welcome," cried several bandits of Ferrucino, Pampinara, and Anagni, who had recognized Luigi Vampa. "Yes, but I come to ask something more than to be your companion." "And what may that be?" inquired the bandits with astonishment. "I come to ask to be your captain," said the young man. The bandits shouted with laughter. "And what have you done to aspire to this honour?" demanded the lieutenant. "I have killed your chief, Cucumetto, whose dress I now wear, and I set fire to the Villa San Felice to procure a wedding dress for my betrothed." An hour afterwards, Luigi Vampa was chosen captain, Vice Cucumetto deceased. "Well, my dear Albert," said Franz, turning towards his friend, "what think you of citizen Luigi Vampa?"
"I say he is a myth," replied Albert, "and never had an existence."
"And what may a myth be?" inquired Pastrini.
"The explanation would be too long, my dear landlord," replied Franz. "And you say that Maitre Vampa exercises his profession at this moment in the environs of Rome,
and with a boldness of which no bandit before him ever gave an example."
"Then the police have vainly tried to lay hands on him."
"Why, you see, he has a good understanding with the shepherds in the plains, the fishermen of the Tiber, and the smugglers of the coast. They seek for him in the mountains, and he is on the waters. They follow him on the waters, and he is on the open sea. Then they pursue him, and he has suddenly taken refuge in the Isle of Giglio, or Guanuti, or Monte Cristo. And when they hunt for him there, he reappears suddenly at Albano, Tivoli, or La Riccia."
"And how does he behave towards travellers?"
"Alas, his plan is very simple. It depends on the distance he may be from the city, whether he gives 8 hours, 12 hours, or a day wherein to pay their ransom. And when that time has elapsed, he allows another hour's grace. At the 60th minute of this hour, if the money is not forthcoming, he blows out the prisoner's brains with a pistol shot, or plants his dagger in his heart, and that settles the account."
"Well, Albert," inquired Franz of his companion, "are you still disposed to go to the Colosseum by the outer boulevard?"
"Perfectly," said Albert, "if the way be picturesque."
The clock struck 9 as the door opened and a coachman appeared.
"Excellencies," said he, "the coach is ready."
"Well then," said Franz, "let us to the Colosseum."
"By the Porto del Popolo or by the streets, your excellencies?"
"By the streets, morbleu, by the streets," cried Franz.
"Ah, my dear fellow," said Albert, rising and lighting his 3rd cigar, "really, I thought you had more courage." So saying, the 2 young men went down the staircase and got into the carriage.
This book is continued on Disc 2.
The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas.
Disc 2.
35. The Colosseum. Franz had so managed his route that during the ride to the Colosseum they passed not a single ancient ruin, so that no gradual preparation was made on the mind for the colossal proportions of the gigantic building they came to admire. This itinerary possessed another great advantage, that of leaving Franz at full liberty to indulge his deep reverie upon the subject of the story recounted by Maitre Pastrini, in which his mysterious host of the Isle of Monte Cristo was so strangely mixed up. Seated with folded arms in a corner of the carriage, he continued to ponder over the singular history he had so lately listened to, and to ask himself an interminable number of questions touching its various circumstances, without, however, arriving at a satisfactory reply to any of them. One fact more than the rest brought his friend Sinbad the Sailor back to his recollection, and that was the mysterious sort of intimacy that seemed to exist between the brigands and sailors, and Pastrini's account of Vampa's having found refuge on board the vessels of smugglers and fishermen reminded Franz of the 2 Corsican bandits he had found supping so amicably with the crew of the little yacht which had even deviated from its course and touched at Porto Vecchio for the sole purpose of landing them. The very name assumed by his host of Monte Cristo, and again repeated by the landlord of the Hôtel de Londres, abundantly proved to him that his island friend was playing his philanthropic part equally on the shores of Piombino, Civita Vecchia, Ostia, and Gaeta, as on those of Corsica, Tuscany, and Spain. And further, Franz bethought him of having heard his singular entertainer speak both of Tunis and Palermo, proving thereby how largely his circle of acquaintances extended. But however the mind of the young man might be absorbed in these reflections, they were at once dispersed at the sight of the dark frowning ruins of the stupendous Colosseum, through the various openings of which the pale moonlight played and flickered like the unearthly gleam from the eyes of the wandering dead. The carriage stopped near the Meta Sudans. The door was opened, and the young men, eagerly alighting, found themselves opposite a cicerone, who appeared to have sprung up from the ground, so unexpected was his appearance. The usual guide from the hotel having followed them, they had paid two conductors. Nor is it possible at Rome to avoid this abundant supply of guides. Besides the ordinary cicerone who seizes upon you directly you set foot in your hotel and never quits you while you remain in the city, there is also a special cicerone belonging to each monument, nay, almost to each part of a monument. As for Albert and Franz, they essayed not to escape from their ciceronian tyrants, and indeed it would have been so much the more difficult to break their bondage, as the guides alone are permitted to visit these monuments with torches in their hands. Thus, then, the young men made no attempt at resistance, but blindly and confidingly surrendered themselves into the care and custody of their conductors. Albert had already made 7 or 8 similar excursions to the Colosseum, while his less favoured companion trod for the first time in his life the classic ground forming the monument of Flavius Vespasian, and, to his credit be it spoken, his mind, even amid the glib loquacity of the guides, was duly and deeply touched with awe and enthusiastic admiration of all he saw. Certainly no adequate notion of these stupendous ruins can be formed, save by such as have visited them, and more especially by moonlight. Then the vast proportions of the building appear twice as large as when viewed by the mysterious beams of a southern moonlit sky, whose rays are sufficiently clear and vivid to gild the horizon with a glow equal to the soft twilight of an eastern clime. Scarcely, therefore, had the reflective Franz walked 100 steps beneath the interior porticos of the ruin, than, abandoning Albert to the guides, Franz ascended a half-dilapidated staircase, and leaving them to follow their monotonous round, seated himself at the foot of a column, and immediately opposite a large chasm, which permitted him to enjoy a full and undisturbed view of the gigantic dimensions of this majestic ruin. Franz had remained for nearly a quarter of an hour perfectly hidden by the shadow of the vast column at whose base he had found a resting place, and from whence his eyes followed the motions of Albert and his guides, when all at once his ear caught a sound resembling that of a stone rolling down the staircase opposite the one by which he had himself ascended. There was nothing remarkable in the circumstance of a morsel of granite giving way and falling heavily below, but it seemed to him that the substance that fell gave way beneath the pressure of a foot, and also that someone, who endeavoured as much as possible to prevent his footsteps from being heard, was approaching the spot where he sat. Conjecture soon became certainty, for the figure of a man was distinctly visible to Franz, gradually emerging from the staircase opposite, upon which the moon was at that moment pouring a full tide of silvery brightness. The stranger thus presenting himself was probably a person who, like Franz, preferred the enjoyment of solitude and his own thoughts to the frivolous gabble of the guides, and his appearance had nothing extraordinary in it. But the hesitation with which he proceeded onwards, stopping and listening with anxious attention at every step he took, convinced Franz he expected the arrival of some person. By a sort of instinctive impulse, Franz withdrew as much as possible behind his pillar. About 10 feet from the spot where himself and the stranger were placed, the roof had given way, leaving a large round aperture through which might be seen the blue vault of heaven thickly studded with stars. Around this opening, which had possibly for ages permitted a free entrance to the brilliant moonbeams that now illumined the vast pile, grew a quantity of creeping plants, whose delicate green branches stood out in bold relief against the clear azure of the firmament, while large masses of thick, strong, fibrous shoots forced their way through the chasm and hung floating to and fro like so many waving strings. The person whose mysterious arrival had attracted the attention of France stood in a kind of half-light that rendered it impossible to distinguish his features, although his dress was easily made out. He wore a large brown mantle, one fold of which, thrown over his left shoulder, served likewise to mask the lower part of his countenance, while the upper part was completely hidden by his broad-brimmed hat. The lower part of his dress was more distinctly visible by the bright rays of the moon, which, entering through the broken ceiling, shed their refulgent beams on feet cased in elegantly made boots of polished leather, over which descended fashionably cut trousers of black cloth. From the imperfect means France had of judging, he could only come to one conclusion, that the individual whom he was thus watching certainly belonged to no inferior station in life. Some few minutes had elapsed, and the stranger began to show manifest signs of impatience, when a slight noise was heard outside the aperture in the roof, and almost immediately a dark shadow seemed to obstruct the flood of light that had entered from it, and the figure of a man was clearly seen gazing with eager scrutiny on the immense space beneath him. Then, as his eye caught sight of the individual in the mantle, he grasped a floating mass of thickly matted boughs, and glided down by their help to within 3 or 4 feet of the ground, and then leaped lightly on his feet. The man who had performed this daring act with so much indifference wore the costume of Trastevere. "I beg your Excellency's pardon for keeping you waiting," said the man in the Roman dialect, "but I don't think I'm many minutes after my time. 10 o'clock has just struck by the clock of Saint-Jean-de-Latran." "Say not a word about being late," replied the stranger, in purest Tuscan. "'Tis I who am too soon. But even if you had caused me to wait a little while, I should have felt quite sure that the delay was not occasioned by any fault of yours. Your Excellency is perfectly right in so thinking," said the man. "I came here direct from the Chateau Saint-Ange." "And what news did you glean? That 2 executions of considerable interest will take place the day after tomorrow at 2 o'clock, as is customary at Rome at the commencement of all great festivals. One of the culprits will be Mazzolato. He is an atrocious villain who murdered the priest who brought him up and deserves not the smallest pity. The other sufferer is sentenced to be decapitato, and he, your Excellency, is poor Peppino. The fact is that you have inspired not only the pontifical government, but also the neighboring states with such extreme fear that they are glad of an opportunity of making an example. But Peppino did not even belong to my band. He was merely a poor shepherd whose only crime consisted in furnishing us with provisions, which makes him your accomplice to all intents and purposes. But mark the distinction with which he is treated. Instead of being knocked on the head, as you would be if once they caught hold of you, he is simply sentenced to be guillotined, by which means, too, the amusements of the day are diversified, and there is a spectacle to please every spectator. Without reckoning the wholly unexpected one, I am preparing to surprise them with, my good friend," said the man in the cloak. "Excuse me for saying that you seem to me precisely in the mood to commit some wild or extravagant act. Perhaps I am. But one thing I have resolved on, and that is to stop at nothing to restore a poor devil to liberty who has got into this scrape solely from having served me. I should hate and despise myself as a coward did I desert the brave fellow in his present extremity. And what do you mean to do? To surround the scaffold with 20 of my best men, who, at a signal from me, will rush forward directly Peppino is brought for execution, and by the assistance of their stilettos, drive back the guard and carry off the prisoner. That seems to me as hazardous as uncertain, and convinces me my scheme is far better than yours. And what is your Excellency's project? Just this. I will so advantageously bestow 2,000 piastres that the person receiving them shall obtain a respite till next year for Peppino. and during that year another skilfully placed 1,000 piastres shall afford him the means of escaping from his prison. I can do more single-handed by the means of gold than you and all your troop could effect with stilettos, pistols, carbines, and blunderbusses included. Leave me then to act, and have no fears for the result. At least there can be no harm in myself and party being in readiness in case your excellency should fail, none whatever. Take what precautions you please, if it is any satisfaction to you to do so, but rely upon my obtaining the reprieve I seek. Remember, the execution is fixed for the day after tomorrow, and that you have but one day to work in. And what then? Is not a day divided into 24 hours, each hour into 60 minutes, and every minute subdivided into 60 seconds? Now, in 86,400 seconds, very many things can be done. And how shall I know whether your excellency has succeeded or not? Oh, that is very easily arranged. I have engaged the 3 lower windows of the Café Rospoli. Should I have obtained the requisite pardon for Peppino, the 2 outside windows will be hung with yellow damasks, and the centre with white, having a large cross in red marked on it. And whom will you employ to carry the reprieve to the officer directing the execution? Send one of your men disguised as a penitent friar, and I will give it to him. His dress will procure him the means of approaching the scaffold itself, and will deliver the official order to the officer, who, in his turn, will hand it to the executioner. In the meantime, it will be as well to acquaint Peppino with what we have determined on, if it be only to prevent his dying of fear or losing his senses, because in either case a very useless expense will have been incurred. Your excellency, said the man, you are fully persuaded of my entire devotion to you, are you not? Nay, I flatter myself that there can be no doubt of it, replied the cavalier in the cloak. Well then, only fulfill your promise of rescuing Peppino, and henceforward you shall receive not only devotedness, but the most absolute obedience from myself and those under me that one human being can render to another. Have a care how far you pledge yourself, my good friend, for I may remind you of your promises at some perhaps not very distant period, when I, in my turn, may require your aid and influence. Let that day come soon or late, your excellency will find me what I have found you in this my heavy trouble. And if, from the other end of the world, you but write me word to do such or such a thing, conclude it done, for done it shall be. On the word and faith of hush, interrupted the stranger, I hear a noise. 'Tis some travellers who are visiting the Colosseum by torchlight. 'Twere better we should not be seen together. Those guides are nothing but spies, and might possibly recognize you. And however I may be honored by your friendship, my worthy friend, if once the extent of our intimacy were known, I am sadly afraid both my reputation and credit would suffer thereby. Well then, if you obtain the reprieve, the middle window at the Café Rospoli will be hung with white damask, bearing on it a red cross. And if you fail, then all 3 windows will have yellow draperies. And then, my good fellow, use your daggers in any way you please, and I further promise you to be there as a spectator of your prowess. All is then understood between us. Adieu, your excellency. Depend upon me as firmly as I do upon you. Saying these words, the Transtaveri disappeared down the staircase, while his companion, muffling his features more closely than before in the folds of his mantle, passed almost close to Franz, and descended to the arena by an outward flight of steps. The next minute Franz heard himself called by Albert, who made the lofty building re-echo with the sound of his friend's name. Franz, however, did not obey the summons till he had satisfied himself the 2 individuals, whose conversation he had thus surprised, were at a sufficient distance to prevent his encountering them in his descent, not wishing that they should suspect having had a witness to their discourse, who, if unable to recognize their faces, had at least heard every word that passed. In 10 minutes from the parting of the strangers, Franz was on the road to the Hôtel d'Espagne. One of the two men whose mysterious rendezvous in the Colosseum he had so unintentionally witnessed was an entire stranger to him, but not so the other. And though Franz had been unable to distinguish his features from his being either wrapped in his mantle or obscured by the shadow, the tones of his voice had made too powerful an impression on him the first time he heard them for him ever again to forget them, hear them when or where he might. It was more especially when speaking in a manner half jesting, half bitter, that Franz's ear recalled most vividly the deep, sonorous, yet well-pitched voice that had spoken to him in the grotto of Monte Cristo, and which he heard for the second time amid the darkness and ruined grandeur of the Colosseum. And the more he thought, the more entire was his conviction that the individual in the mantle was no other than his former host and entertainer, Sinbad the Sailor. Under any other circumstances, Franz would have found it impossible to resist his extreme curiosity to know more of so singular a personage, and with that intent have sought to renew their short acquaintance. But in the present instance, the confidential nature of the conversation he had overheard made him with propriety judge that his appearance at such a time would be anything but agreeable. As we have seen, therefore, he permitted his former host to retire without attempting a recognition, but fully promising himself a rich indemnity for his present forbearance should chance afford him another opportunity. In vain did Franz endeavour to forget the many perplexing thoughts which assailed him. In vain did he court the refreshment of sleep. Worn out at length, he fell asleep at daybreak and did not awake till late. Like a genuine Frenchman, Albert had employed his time in arranging for the evening's diversion. He had sent to engage a box at the Teatro Argentino, and Franz, having a number of letters to write, relinquished the carriage to Albert for the whole of the day. At 5 o'clock, Albert returned, delighted with his day's work. He had been occupied in leaving his letters of introduction, and had received in return more invitations to balls and soirees than it would be possible for him to fulfil. Besides this, he had seen, as he called it, all the remarkable sights at Rome. Yes, in a single day he had accomplished what his more reflective companion would have taken weeks to effect. Neither had he neglected to ascertain the name of the piece to be played that night at the Teatro Argentino, and also what performers appeared in it. The opera of Parisina was announced for representation, and the principal actors were Corselli, Moriani, and La Speck. The young men, therefore, had reason to consider themselves fortunate in having the opportunity of hearing one of the best works by the composer of Lucia de Lammermoor, supported by three of the most renowned vocalists of Italy. Albert had never been able to endure the Italian theatres, with their orchestras from which it is impossible to see, and the absence of balconies or open boxes. All these defects pressed hard on a man who had had his stall at the opera Buffa and his share in the omnibus box at the Italian opera. Still, in despite of this, Albert displayed his most dazzling and effective costume each time he visited the theatres. But alas, his recherché toilette was wholly thrown away, and one of the most worthy representatives of Parisian fashion had to carry with him the mortifying reflection of having nearly overrun Italy without meeting a single adventure. Sometimes Albert would affect to make a joke of his want of success, but internally he was deeply wounded, and his self-love immensely piqued to think that Albert de Morcerf, the most admired and most sought after of any young person of his day, should thus be passed over, and merely have his labour for his pains. And the thing was so much the more annoying as, according to the characteristic modesty of a Frenchman, Albert had quitted Paris with the full conviction that he had only to show himself in Italy to carry all before him, and that upon his return he should astonish the Parisian world with the recital of his numerous love affairs. Alas, poor Albert, none of those interesting adventures fell in his way. The lovely Genoese, Florentine, and Neapolitan females were all faithful, if not to their husbands, at least to their lovers, and thought not of changing even for the splendid appearance of Albert de Morcerf. And all he gained was the painful conviction that the ladies of Italy have this advantage over those of France, that they are faithful even in their infidelity. yet he could not restrain a hope that, in Italy as elsewhere, there might be an exception to the general rule. Albert, besides being an elegant, well-looking young man, was also possessed of considerable talent and ability. Moreover, he was a viscount, a recently created one, certainly, but in the present day it is not necessary to go as far back as Noah in tracing a descent, and a genealogical tree is equally estimated, whether dated from 1399 or merely 1815. To crown all these advantages, Albert de Morcerf commanded an income of 50,000 livres, £2,000, a more than sufficient sum to render him a personage of considerable importance in Paris. Albert, however, hoped to indemnify himself for all these slights and indifferences during the carnival, knowing full well that among the different states and kingdoms in which this festivity is celebrated, Rome is the spot where even the wisest and gravest throw off the usual rigidity of their lives and deign to mingle in the follies of this time of liberty and relaxation. The carnival was to commence on the morrow. Therefore, Albert had not an instant to lose in setting forth the programme of his hopes, expectations, and claims to notice. With this design, he had engaged a box in the most conspicuous part of the theatre, and exerted himself to set off his personal attractions by the aid of the most recherché and elaborate toilette. The box taken by Albert was in the first circle. Although each of the three tiers of boxes is deemed equal